Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. We're taking a dose of our own medicine with a short summer sabbatical as we focus on some other projects. While we're away, we're going to be setting up a health centre in Switzerland and offering heart-based medicine to Ukrainian and Swiss families. We'll be back again with you in the fall, and until then, we thought you might like to listen to some earlier podcasts with some notable thought leaders in the medical world which haven't yet been broadcast.
We hope you enjoy the podcast.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for putting this together.
We had a chance today to talk about heart-based medicine during the board meeting and during the opening ceremony. And I just wonder, what does heart-based medicine look like for you, if you were to describe it in your own terms?
Now, the first kind of sense that I have is that people are called to a life path in the healing professions because of a care for the quality of experience of other people and the actual sacredness of human life and human experience and wanting to be in service to and devotion to that. So heart-based medicine would be where the entire system of medicine and all of the interactions were designed from and in service to that devotion and that sacredness.
So heart-based medicine is about a sacred space for you.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about medicine being preventing and correcting illness and promoting health, people's experience of life and what they can do with their life to affect the experience of others is sacred. So then medicine is what is in service to their capacity to experience life fully and contribute to life fully.
Beautiful. In many ways, this is where medicine is coming from, at least in our part of the world and our cultures. But medicine was very much in the domain of the religious missions. And that was the understanding of health care. That was the understanding of care given and of elevating the potential of the ones we serve.
Yeah.
Is this something very specific to our cultures? Or is this something that you see as a, if you like, as a principle beyond the kind of cultural and religious backgrounds that we share in Western Europe?
I think this might be as unifying a thing across cultures as there is in terms of medicine women and medicine men and shamans and Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, like early humans figuring out how do we care for each other? How do we care for ourselves? How do we prevent illness? How do we fix illness? Obviously, the whole focus to do that would be not just self-preservation, but also care for each other. So I think that's probably as unifying a thing as there is.
Yeah. So care is the unifying principle. So if care is the unifying principle, and we see that all the talk in healthcare about the importance of care, and we see how it is delivered, what do you see as the current, the strongest obstacles, if you like, those elements in our current healthcare system and the way that we go about healthcare? What do you see as the current obstacles to deliver the kind of care that we would perceive as sacred?
A lot, actually. I'm happy to unpack this, but there's a lot of systemic factors. There's obviously trillions of dollars flowing through the thing we call global healthcare industrial complex writ large, and pharmaceuticals and hospitals and industries and insurance industries. There's also all of the money in the world flowing through things that affect health. When we look at the burning of coal and oil and what that does to the environment that then we're embedded in and breathing and drinking the water from, when we look at agriculture that depletes the topsoil or sprays glyphosate on all the food, like upstream from someone being sick and coming to the hospital is, do we actually have a civilization that's promoting health? And in how many places do we have a civilization that through structures that create ubiquitous psychological stress and structures that actually, again, expose us to ubiquitous pollution and poor forms of nutrition. When you just think about it, like the goal of almost every business is to maximize the lifetime revenue of a customer, and nothing does that better than addiction. Obviously, the supply side might be a multi-billion dollar company relative to an individual consumer, and so there's a kind of asymmetric warfare in terms of their capacity to influence with commercial media, you know, so many things. So if we wanted a society that was promoting maximum health, we would want to be minimizing addiction everywhere, which would mean that any place where addiction was profitable, we would have a fundamental conflict. We'd have a perverse incentive in the nature of that type of market dynamic. So, you know, I think there's a huge amount of perverse incentive. That's one place where there are structural issues. I think that there are places where, out of caution, because of malpractice and whatever else, hospitals create policies. There are insurance guidelines that actually don't allow doctors to do things that would demonstrate certain kinds of care. I think that we have a medical school system where the average amount of nutrition that is taught to a medical doctor is extraordinarily low relative to the importance of nutrition and health. But similarly, how much psychology should actually be taught so that the doctor can actually really understand the experience of the patient well and be able to relate and work through that should be a much bigger percentage of the training that occurs. I think we also have a situation where you can't actually measure the felt sense of love and care in the same way that you can measure cholesterol and blood pressure. And so you end up optimizing for the things that you measure. I think MRI machines are expensive and they're important. So you make big hospitals that a lot of people go to as opposed to small county clinics, and because there's economies of scale. But I think the economies of scale mean you don't really know your doctor. Your doctor doesn't know you. You're one of maybe hundreds or thousands of people that they're going to see. And so I think, again, the economies of scale end up really damaging personal connection and personal rapport. I think the most important diagnostic tool there is really detailed medical intake and really having the time to think through and pay attention, and then a continuity of being able to think about that for the patient. And there's just, that requires a certain amount of time being allocated. So I think there's a lot of structural factors that are oriented to things like lowering liability and maximizing profit and economies of scale, all of which are not optimized for what supposedly the whole thing is in service to.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. It can resonate very much with the importance of an intake that is based on a deep listening and really being present with the patient and understanding where they're coming from and seeing that disease through their eyes. You were talking about, you're touching on many issues, but you were also touching on one of the points you're raising, is that the person's subjective experience of their disease and how they feel and what it means to their lives is something that is worth exploring, and yet it is hard to measure. So the measures that we currently have available, are they too crude, or are they just, is it just structurally impossible to measure the subjective experience?
Well, by definition, it is structurally impossible to measure subjective experience. A measurement means some needle move, means it's in the domain of the objective or third person. I can measure a neural correlate. I can measure a endocrine correlate. Otherwise, I have to actually listen to the person report their own experience. Then, of course, we're going to have all the biases that self-reporting has, and someone having reasons that they don't want to say how miserable they are, or they want to exaggerate it for empathy, or they have a limited vocabulary to express it. So I do think that there is a need for a lot of question asking of things that cannot be measured in blood tests.
So how do we deal with this approach? So we know that when we talk to patients, that we find out things, and as you say, there are biases. So there are preferences, there's recall, there's all sorts of things that affect this. And a lot of the approaches that we take in everyday routine clinics is trying to insert some objectivity into this assessment, seeing to what degree can we rely on this. But in a way, what we do is we take our tests that we apply our observations of that person that we call objective observations. We take those as the reference point, and whatever the patient says is measured against that. Yet when I hear you correctly, then what we really want to do is we want to improve on understanding the subjective experience better.
Okay, so there's a number of parts we can look at here. There's the way that someone's subjective experience affects their objective physiology, right? So the whole domain of psychoneuroimmunology and the way that stress affects health and the way that better psychological disposition, placebo dynamics, et cetera, affect health. So we want to actually be able to work with people's subjective experience as part of medicine. That's one thing. The other thing is that some people might have a disease that can't be cured and actually still have a good subjective experience of life based on their focus and their meaning making versus having a totally ruined experience of life. So subjective experience is a terminal value in and of itself. It is both useful for supporting objective physiologic health, and it is intrinsically valuable independent of physiologic health. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of other reasons to talk to a patient and ask them questions, though. You and I were talking before that modern allopathic medicine does a really good job in places where we actually understand the causation clearly. And generally, that tends to be more in the direction of things that were acute. Like an acute injury, it's pretty clear, like, oh, there was a puncture wound. We're going to sew up the puncture wound. Or there was an acute infection, and we can see what type of infection it is. Maybe an antibiotic can treat it. Or there was an acute poisoning, and we're going to do an acute kind of detox. But there was an acute incident and then immediate symptomology, and we can trace causation. But with autoimmune disease and with cognitive decline and neurodegenerative disease and psychiatric disease and cancer, that's not the case. And so for the most part, we don't actually know why those things are happening. And it happens to be my belief, similar to much of the kind of functional medicine and naturopathic world, that most of those diseases are multifactorial. They don't have one cause. They have a lot of causes. And it's not the same set of causes every time. So there actually isn't one thing called rheumatoid arthritis or one thing called MS from a pathoideology point of view. There's a system that's being exposed to things that don't create immediate symptomology, but that are dysregulating homeodynamics. Mm. And those dysregulated homeodynamics make one more susceptible to the additional stressors, dysregulating homeodynamics more, until eventually we cross a threshold and now we get symptomology and biomarkers. Mm-hmm. And a cluster of symptomology and biomarkers gets a disease name. But if I really start paying attention to those things and wanting to be able to trace a complex causal situation that's multifactorial and maybe very delayed causation in time, then I want a totally different kind of intake, right? I might want to be asking really detailed questions to see when they've ever been exposed to mold or when they were ever exposed to industrial chemicals or they spend a lot of time with epoxy at a certain point or whatever it is, or when they had third world travels where they got nasty infections and what symptoms. So I want a timeline of when different symptoms kicked on and a timeline of different kinds of stresses and exposures, when there was a microtraumatic brain injury that didn't show up in an MRI, but it doesn't mean that there actually wasn't a micro TBI that affected functional patterning in the brain. And if I'm able to look at the current symptomology, the current labs, the progression of symptomology and the progression of exposures and have all of that fit together and make sense, then I might be informed as to how to start a treatment that is actually addressing more than just symptomology and, you know, disease manifestation. Mm. And there's no way I'm going to get that without asking them a lot of questions.
Yeah. So is there, do you feel that this is an area of research that is developing?
I mean, I think that the environmental medicine, functional medicine, naturopathic medicine communities have been focused on with chronic complex illness in particular, where the best modern treatments are mostly symptomatic, Not just symptomatic. A biologic can actually decrease the total tissue damage from a connective tissue disorder. And obviously, if we're cutting a cancer out or radiating it out or poisoning it out, that's still better than leaving it there oftentimes. But the why was there increased carcinogenesis in the first place? And why did the body's immune system not deal with the carcinogenesis are still upline questions, especially if we don't want this person to get cancer again. And especially if the things that might have led to it might be signs of underlying dysregulation that affect other things. Mm. So I think there is a increasing awareness that chronic complex illness is not just stupid bodies. It is just kind of deeper complexity where it's not one disease, one cause, and we're going to have one pill. It is radically complex regulatory systems, many different elements of causation that end up leading to things that present like a cluster of symptoms and biomarkers that we call a disease. Mm.
That is very fascinating. I think in most of the research that we see published today, most of the clinical research that we see published today, what I observe is that the schematic, the methodology is very much the same. So we kind of have two points of observation, and between the two points of observation, we assume a linear correlation. But what we don't look at, or if you look at the classic table one in a publication where we're looking at the demographics, comparing the two groups, then you have, you know, three or four or five different variables. So we're looking at, you know, is, you know, gender, ethnicity, age, so really, really crude variables. And at the end, everybody feels comfortable that both groups are comparable. While what we're not looking at all is what happens before the trial. What are these life stories? What is this? The complex of homeodynamic regulatory systems interacting with each other and building up in a way that we have great difficulties to understand that. We certainly don't have any measures or markers for this. When we establish these, let's say if we get better at asking questions and really getting at least a reported picture of what happened, do you feel that the if we basically exploded the number of variables from, you know, age and sex and ethnicity to maybe, let's say, 200 or 500 variables, so if we were compiling this index of measures or indicators, would we really learn more about what happened before an event?
So what are the right methods to gain the kinds of insights we want in a domain as complex as human physiology is a very interesting question. If we look at a clinical trial, say for drug research, that's trying to see, does this drug do something beyond the placebo? We're going to get something like a Gaussian distribution where it's going to work pretty well for some people and it's going to work not well for other people, and there'll be some range of effect for a lot of people. And we just want to see that that's some range of effect, and maybe the front of the bell curve is better than what a placebo is. But why it works really well for these people and not really well for these people, or maybe even really badly for these people, is a bunch of other variables that are just hidden under the shape of a bell curve. And so obviously we would like to find that out. So that doesn't mean that that is a worthless study. That's an interesting study. But if we go all the way to the other end, we get, how can we get as much information about this one person as possible rather than this one drug across all people, right? How can I get as much information about this person? And now we're starting to do N equals one kinds of studies and optimization. So I totally think there are places for clinical trials. Of course, if we have more metrics, if they're appropriate metrics, additional insight comes. Because not just are you likely to be able to see more things, but you also start to get to see what are the relationships between these metrics and are there combinatorial insights. Mm. But as soon as I realized that I'm not just looking at a genome, I'm looking at the combinatorics on all of the polymorphisms possible on all of the genes, and then all the combinatorics on the epigenome, and then the proteome recursively changing it, we're never going to be able to compute all that. It is actually not computable. So there are better ways we have to think about how do we actually understand what health is. And if we think about health as the integrity of the regulatory systems, so the homeodynamics of how the body self-organizes and self-regulates, and the homeodynamic, not just the homeodynamic state, but the homeodynamic capacity, right? Like typically most of the studies that most of the tests we do in medicine are testing state. So we're testing cholesterol level, or we're testing blood sugar, or whatever it is. But what's really going to determine the overall health is much more related to, under some kind of stress, how does the body maintain being within a homeodynamic range? So, you know, we do this sometimes with a glucose stress test or with a stress echocardiogram, and those are super insightful. But there's a lot of things we don't do those with where it might be in range, but very fragile and could come out of range easily, which means that the person doesn't have a disease, but they're very susceptible. Mm-hmm. And so, yet if I see very high homeodynamic capacity across lots of axes, that's a measure of the robustness of health. Mm-hmm. Different types of interesting diagnostics in the future.
Mm. Thank you. So what I hear from you is, assuming linear unicausal association is a degree of simplification that
silly
is really not very helpful.
I mean, for some things, in the knife wound case, it's fine.
Yeah.
Except we need to ask, you know, are they clumsy or are they getting in knife fights for dumb reasons? So there might be something upstream. But so for some things, unicausal is fine. Mm-hmm. But for most anything that emerged not immediately following an obvious causation event, this is why we don't actually have real cures. We have symptomatic treatments and, you know, ameliorative treatments for most complex chronic disease.
So the etiology of disease, we will more likely find answers for what is the real cause of disease if we look at non-linear models and we look at the period before the disease started, before the symptoms occur, and see what are the different factors that have built up and reached that threshold.
Yeah. Mm.
When you speculate about what might be the areas that affect the human body, what are the areas that, if they stack up, will lead to an imbalance, a dysregulation that becomes symptomatic?
Yeah.
What do you believe are those areas?
You know, there's some actual pretty simple models we can start to look at this comprehensively through. So in Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine actually had some kind of good holistic heuristics to start with, even though they didn't have all of the assessments we have. Like, say you take a roughly Chinese medicine point of view of where is there too much of something, where is there not enough of something? So toxicity and deficiency. This is a pretty good starting model for predispositions towards disease. So you can think about that we evolved to be able to, like our genetics evolved to have a certain set of behaviors interacting with a certain set of environmental parameters. So where our behaviors are very different than kind of what we evolved to handle, or where our environment is meaningfully different, those are going to be interesting things to look at. So, you know, too much. Well, too much can look like things that we shouldn't have any amount of, like glyphosate and pesticides and, you know, and we're really kind of ubiquitously exposed to the volatile organic compounds coming out of this carpet and out of the paint, right? There's, we have built a world that we're actually not genetically fit for, where there are externalities to our health of the ways that we do lots of things. And so when you look at all the volatile organic compounds or all of the, you know, petrochemicals that are in the environment, most of them are either endocrine disruptors or neurotoxins or carcinogens. So then we look at how many diseases fit into those being part of the underlying ideology, right? So too much of things that shouldn't have really been there at all. And but obviously too much sugar, or, you know, there can be excesses of certain nutrients in relationship to other nutrients like zinc copper balance or calcium magnesium balance or things like that. Obviously, we're not just limited to talking about environmental toxins that aren't alive. We can also talk about things that are alive. So infection would be kind of a subclass of too much of something. And that can either be things that should be there, but they're overgrown, like SIBO and other kinds of microbiome disorders, or actual infections, but pathogens that are not normally part of our healthy kind of microbiome. And this is where the concept of a subclinical infection or a subclinical toxicity is important, which is, let's say that I have a level of mercury exposure or a level of lead exposure where we're going to say, oh, yes, I have lead poisoning. Well, lead poisoning is at this threshold, but the ideal amount of lead that I would have would be down here. Well, there's a whole level in here, which is I don't yet have the level that we would diagnose with acute lead poisoning that is more than none. It has some effect. And that also ends up being true with infections that are not necessarily showing up as acute infection, but are testable and that have effect. So we see Helicobacter pylori in the stomach being able to cause ulcers and cause stomach cancer over a very long time period, or HPV and, you know, cervical cancer or throat cancer, things like that. For those few that we found recently, it's pretty safe to assume that there's lots more like that where the correlations are just not as clear yet. And that's one of the things that, again, some of the infectious study and environmental toxicology studies that functional medicine is doing, I think, are really interesting. So too much of various things, not enough of. And obviously we can look at things like not enough exercise, not enough sleep, not enough human contact. But not enough human contact is actually profound, because that ends up being one of the most profound drivers of addiction, which is then going to cause so many other health issues. But also not enough of specific nutrients. And we see that we have a, you know, modern American diet or modern industrial world diet is very high in macronutrients and often low in really critical micronutrients. And longevity is usually best optimized by lower macronutrients and higher micronutrients, which is closer to what evolutionary environments would have. So that's like a starting framework.
Thank you. So here you have identified areas or risk factors, and if they're compiling, they might add. So these are the areas that we would like to explore further and more deeply in an intake, as you described, where we ask lots of questions and try to understand what happened before the patient has reached a state of disease.
Yeah.
When we don't have a lot of time when talking to the patients, and you mentioned the systemic factors, the limiting factors of how we are setting up our healthcare system, certainly I feel that limited time is a critical factor. We need to make choices. We need to make choices about what questions to ask. And one way is to go through a protocol. One way is to go through a long list of questions and kind of ask all the possible questions. And then hope that either ourselves or some computer will be able to make sense of it. And then there's another way to make choices. And that depends, it involves the observer. It involves the healthcare provider. So it involves the way we show up as a healthcare provider, we relate to the patient, and we ask these questions. We briefly touched on the subjective experience of the disease, and you touched on homeodynamics as the key principle to understand behind disease evolution. Now, if we see that you're a homeodynamic system and I'm a homeodynamic system, is there a way that those two systems can come into resonance? Is there a way that I can tune my system into yours? And by doing so, I can actually ask the right questions.
I would ask you as a clinician, have you had this experience?
Yeah. That's what it seems like.
I don't think we have to get hung up on wondering what the mechanism of intuition is to acknowledge that there's a reality to it. Mm-hmm. Is it some electromagnetic resonance that's happening? Maybe. That's a cool idea. Is it simply that I have a lot of experience, and when I take the time to quiet, I process the information in my own internal neurologic database better? That's a fine idea too. I actually don't want to attach to a mechanistic explanation of how intuition works that someone can say not well enough verified and reject, to say that increasing awareness and presence and perceptivity is valuable. And it will lead to better insights from wherever that comes about what's going on with the patient and how to ask the right questions.
That's interesting. So you're leaving care as a sacred space, and you're leaving intuition as a sacred space. So it feels like we need to talk about love. In a way, connecting the two, at least that's what it feels like to me. Here's another sacred space and another question of, can we measure or should we measure, or what might be the value of measuring how we relate and how we describe the phenomenon of love or resonance?
We talked about this earlier. We can't measure love. We can measure things going on with the physiology when we say that we're feeling something that we call love that maybe statistically correlate to some degree. And whether I'm measuring oxytocin and other kind of neurohormones and neurotransmitters, or I'm measuring heart rate variability or measuring some kind of EEG coherence pattern, those aren't useless things to do. Like, that's interesting. But I could just say, pick the right person to marry on paper, whether you have any feelings for them or not, and just snort oxytocin regularly, because love is just oxytocin. And most people don't resonate with that, or or, you know, do a particular kind of transcranial magnetic stimulation to the brain region that we identified as where love is happening, and there it is. When a parent wakes up who is sick and who hasn't slept in a long time, who has an infant who's worn out as can be to take care of their infant. Love is motivating them, but they might feel like shit in the moment. And love doesn't really feel like a subjective emotion. It's actually something deeper than emotion. It's transcendent to emotion. It can move them even through emotion. And we might not see the particular great heart rate variability in that moment or whatever it is. So I think it's interesting to study correlation between physiology and subjective states. But I think if we're studying it through the method of science, and we can do a lot more with the objective within the method of science, because that's what we study, things that are measurable and repeatable, and experience, subjective experience is neither measurable nor repeatable, then the temptation is going to be to reduce subjectivity to being an epiphenomena of objectivity. And in doing so, then consciousness is illusory and choice is illusory. Or their consciousness is real as an epiphenomena, but choice is illusory because everything that happens in the brain is controlled by particle physics of the voltage differentials of sodium ions. That's the exact opposite of heart-based anything, right? Like that is kind of maximum reductionism. And it's not even epistemically well-founded. It's a category error of seeing that there is some pretty low degree of information theoretic correlation between objective and subjective, pretending that it's perfect, and then pretending that this is the epiphenomenon of this one because this is the one that we know how to actually make causal sense of. Do I think it's important to have some way of noticing how the doctor and how the nurse and how the practitioners feel before they're with patients, and that they're paying attention to how the patients are feeling, and that they're paying attention to the quality of the relationship? Totally. I don't think you can measure that. I think you can pay attention to it. I think that you might have some indices that are worth noticing, but there will be meaningful things that can't be brought into an index. And the moment you do, you're actually collapsing something very information rich to something very not information rich. And you're losing so much information in the process that if you make your decisions as a hospital or an insurance company or a doctor based off the thing that lost all the information, and then you normalize this is the thing we want to do, you'll mess it up.
Beautiful. So basically our attempt to simplify questions so that we feel comfortable to answer them, so this reductionist approach limits our ability to see just by the fact that we're setting targets to see them.
Yeah. The Tao that is nameable is not the eternal Tao. So ultimately, good medicine is not purely algorithmic. And our job is not just to try and be robots that just get data that we just haven't got good enough robots to do yet, but we'll be replaced by them, and then do if this, then that programs. It's actually not that. That's not the job. That's a part of the job, but that's definitely not the whole totality of the job. So there is something to what medicine is that is trans-algorithmic. And so then you have to say, well, if we're going to be training doctors, and if we're going to be evaluating them based on a set of metrics and a scorecard, so then they are going to try and perform to the scorecard, they're going to mess up the actual thing. This is how I interpret what the no false idols thing is about, right? Mm-hmm. Is that kind of graven image of that set of metrics isn't actually the thing that it's pointing at. It's not worthless to pay attention to those things, but you actually have to have your choice making be bound to the actual reality, not the information reduced model.
That's very interesting, particularly when we think of artificial intelligence entering the space of medicine. So when we look at now, there are computers being built that are exhibiting some features that we would describe as compassionate, for example, non-judgmental listening. So some of the robots are now able to listen to a human being, and in a way that there is a feedback to the one that is talking, but it's non-judgmental.
There's a conflation of ideas in here. To say non-judgmental assumes a binary with judgmental, that where we're correlating our experience of a human that is judgmental or non-judgmental. That computer is not being non-judgmental nor judgmental. There's actually no one home. There is no quality. It is doing an if this then that kind of program. Mm-hmm. And even if it's doing a deep learning program, it is simply a fully causal input-output through some set of program dynamic. Mm-hmm. So it's not really fair to call that non-judgmental. It is doing a function.
It is doing what it's told. And the interesting observation is that when people with certain disease conditions, for example, autistic people, are interacting with these computers, there seems to be a level of trust or acceptance that evolves, and that those patients exhibiting features that we would describe as autistic disease spectrum will reduce, and they will be able to open up and actually start a conversation.
I think that that is a statement of how shitty the parenting is and how shitty the doctors, nurses, and educators are, that the person does better with a robot, like a fairly low-level robot, rather than it is something exciting about AI for me. If someone's doing better with a robot because it simply doesn't seem judgmental and it takes a little space, even though it doesn't love you or care about you, like, that's just a really low bar. I'd rather the person have a dog to spend time with. The thing I'm excited about with AI in the medicine space, and it's confusing to even call it AI, machine learning. Do we want to have machine learning run big data sets to find correlations that we can't currently find? Of course, that's awesome. Do we want to scan all the medical medical records in using image recognition and run massive big data so that we can see early disease indicators we don't currently know? That's awesome. Insofar as, of course, we should be augmenting, just like we augment human memory with books and computers, we should augment human computational process with computational process. So the ability to take a picture of something and have image recognition be able to do better diagnosis of skin conditions, like, all of that's great. And that actually allows, as that gets better, it allows the doctors to be less focused on just memory and computation and more focused on actual connection, to then know how to use that system and to relate to the person. But there's still going to be a pretty big gap between the doctor relating with the person using the system and the system acting on the person directly.
Mm. So you're now juxtaposing the human experience and the development of machine learning, or the availability of machine learning capacity. And we can run this on databases, as you say, but we can also turn them into, we can inform objects that we call robots with machine learning abilities. So they're able to provide services. So what we're seeing is that increasingly now there are kind of robots evolving that are involved in what we typically would call services of care. So, for example, they would help in household activities. They would help in, getting dressed, washing ourselves, very basic day-to-day activities. And they are helpful for people who have incapacity, are somehow don't have the capacity to perform certain activities.
Yeah.
But they're fundamentally different to a nurse coming to the home and actually being with this person and providing that support.
Yeah, there's something about the development of these technologies that is awesome and liberating and helpful. And there's something about the way we are relating to it that is gruesome. And it's important to understand both. Insofar as we're talking about a robotic exoskeleton that can allow a paralyzed person to walk, it's just a better wheelchair. It's just an extension of the tooling we've already been using. You're wearing eyeglasses. That's a tool that helps you. You're a cyborg to some degree. If we had ones that could autofocus and do cool stuff, okay, that's fine. But something that does not actually have the capacity to care about you, replacing a dynamic where care used to occur, is tragic. Now, if it's simply helping you get some stuff done you couldn't otherwise, and hopefully that increases your capacity for authentic human interaction, awesome. But the tendency of hyper-individualization that the modern world has had, modern West in particular has had, every time you see a mass shooter who shoots up a bunch of people at school or somewhere, almost all of the time when the news goes and checks, the neighbors say, yeah, he was super quiet, he kept to himself, nobody ever saw him. Because in a setting where you have a family or an extended family or a village where humans evolve for most of human history, if you're, before you would go kill a bunch of people, you're obviously not happy. And if you're interacting with other people to get your needs met, other people see that, they'll actually be responding and keeping that psychopathology from progressing that far. But if someone can be a shut-in and they can hardly ever interact with anyone and maybe get an Amazon drone delivery to their house so they actually never have to interact with anyone, now they can have some robotic care agent, they can progress in psychopathology both in ways that make them dangerous to society and in ways that just allow them to be suffering gruesomely for a long time. Humans are social primates. We evolved in social environments. We have a world that totally is getting this wrong right now. And we have to turn that thing around for their, not just to like have an optimal world. I actually don't think we have any chance of having a world continue at all from the point of view of existential catastrophic risk if we don't solve this particular thing. Because say someone is progressing in psychopathology and they're really upset, and the best technology for killing they have is a knife. They're just not going to hurt that many people before somebody takes them out. But if it's an AR-15, they can kill a lot more people. With decentralizing exponential technology, when that becomes a CRISPR gene drive pandemic weapon and weaponized drones and et cetera, we just can't have really disaffected people. And that means if I can get all of my needs met without interacting with other humans, then either I have to have some top-down state surveillance system, like the China method, which is already a dystopia, or how do we have access to the level of technological power people will be getting and have us be safe vessels for having that much technological power? Mm-hmm. Well, they have to be no psychologically really damaged people. And if there are any, we have to know. The only way to have that kind of known that doesn't involve top-down state surveillance is the kind of surveillance that a family does, or a tribe does, or a community does, where my resource provisioning requires interacting in healthy ways with people, or unlike the kind of asymmetric surveillance of the state that is just trying to make sure I'm not a bad guy, it's a symmetric paying attention of people that actually want to make sure I'm doing well.
So part of the what you're proposing is a community surveillance in a way. So are you saying basically that doesn't even have to be developed because it's an innate function of building primate communities that we're resonating with each other, and that we're realizing if somebody is behaving kind of outside of the pack, then that is something to be addressed. And would you argue that this is something that is like an existential interest of the group?
Of course.
Because of the potential? So is this like a risk detection system of a group?
Does this mean that nobody can be a hermit? No, of course it doesn't mean nobody can be a hermit. But does it mean that in the presence of decentralizable catastrophe level technology, we have to think about some things differently than we did previously? And the disposition and well-being of people matters more to everyone because the one-to-many capacity of a person is much, much higher. And so the coupling is higher, which means that the care needs to be higher.
Coming back to care again and again and again. So now we're looking at care as a group phenomenon. So a group caring for the group and caring for individuals for the sake of the group.
And for the sake of the individual.
And for the sake of the individual. So if I'm just translating this to the healthcare setting now, where we have a group of people working together and we have individuals walking in and out of this setting, and we look at the current, I want to call it epidemic, of suicide among our colleagues, where are we failing? Have we become numb? Has the system numbed ourselves? Have we lost a sensitivity?
You're specifically talking about suicide amongst doctors? I don't know. I haven't studied this. I would want to really look at, is suicide much higher amongst doctors than other professionals of the same pay grade and other types of similar stress level? I'm sure, again, there's going to be complex causation that's involved. It's not one thing. We can talk about why there are kind of epidemic suicide issues society-wide. I wouldn't want to speak to with doctors without knowing more. But I think it's pretty easy to see at least some things. I think it's pretty easy to see that the amount of stress doctors go through, even in med school, right? Experiencing burnout or being on some kind of Wellbutrin or Adderall or Ritalin or some kind of upper just to make it through school. By the time they're just not even graduating, and then they're supposed to have a whole career of that, and like you mentioned, 72-hour shifts. And I also think that not having a place to process the emotionality of it, the desensitization of, okay, so I just, you know, was a part of some kids dying today, this experience, and I'm going to go do it tomorrow, and where's the space for that? And I think there's obviously a lot of stresses, both that are unavoidably endemic to that profession, that need to be processed in ways that they aren't currently processed, and ones that are avoidable by changing the way the system works.
Mm. So we could, as a group, become more proficient in detecting the dynamics of the group and taking care of each other. And we could become more proficient in the way that we show up as an individual in the group. And that showing up more proficient with our peer group, with our teams, and with the patient will help us to see the patient better, see our colleagues better. And that might create a community that is kind of mutually supportive in a way that we are not so much cluttered by knowledge and red tape, but we can actually allow ourselves to activate our natural capacity to care and our to allow ourselves to be authentic in our natural state of being and connect at that level.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you're talking about the group care between doctors, colleagues. When someone that we know commits suicide, it's such an important inquiry, especially if we didn't know they were close. It's an important inquiry to recognize that you actually don't know how close anyone you're talking to ever is to committing suicide.
Mm.
And you don't know how close to threshold they are and how your interaction is going to affect their relationship to that threshold.
Mm.
And simply being aware of that changes the importance you put on how you show up in all the interactions so much.
Mm. Well, we've come a long way in looking taking a big circle, starting in what does heart-based medicine mean to you? And we're ending on a note of how important it is to develop a sensitivity for each other and to be present with each other and to know and how how many ways this finds reflections in our diagnostic capacity, in the way we devise treatments, in the way we want to create healthcare system that overcomes the many limitations that we're facing at the moment towards a system where people feel seen and heard as human beings rather than being seen as a disease with some kind of background that really doesn't isn't so important for us.
Yeah.
Mm, thank you. Thank you for taking the time being here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for following the call to help this movement birth.
We're on it together.
Thanks for listening to this Heart of Healthcare podcast brought to you by Heart-Based Medicine. If you enjoyed the conversation, you'll find some free resources and more information at heartbasedmedicine.org. Please share this episode if you feel inclined and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Until next time, thanks and take care.